Today, we look at the idea of using vaccine passes to unlock society. Oliver, what's life like in Jerusalem right now?
Well, it's basically how it was before the pandemic hit. I live next to a school. Obviously, during the lockdowns, that school was closed, and now it's open and I can hear them every day in the playground, and that, you know, they're having full classes. And then just round the corner from my house, there's this main road and it's filled with cafes. And now it's completely open again. People are going out in big groups. Shortly after restaurants opened, I saw a table of lots of people, and each one had their own birthday cake. And it was to sort of celebrate all the birthdays they had missed during the pandemic. And life is pretty much back to normal. The only noticeable sign that we're still living under a pandemic is that people are wearing masks outside.
Life sounds pretty good for The Guardian's Jerusalem correspondent, Oliver Holmes. Imagine, nothing that feels like a lockdown in sight. But how has Israel been able to reopen society so fully? As well as a massive vaccination programme, it has introduced a COVID Green Pass that is meant to give the vaccinated exclusive access to gyms, hotels, theatres, restaurants and bars, while keeping the unvaccinated out. Now Britain is thinking about a similar idea, but will it get through Parliament? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, should our COVID status, proven with a pass, determine whether we are allowed to return to everyday activities? I mean, sitting here after 4 months in lockdown, only now able to meet six people outdoors, that sounds pretty amazing. Does it feel like an incredible relief?
It does. It's incredible to see people in the streets hugging and to just see people relax. And you can see there's less tension in their bodies. And it was incredible for me as well to go, you know, with my laptop and go and sit inside a cafe. And there's a few seconds at the beginning where you think, oh, this is a little bit weird. And then it was just straight back to it as if nothing had happened.
So how did it get so free?
So Israel launched what was the world's fastest vaccination campaign. In December, it started inoculating people, and at its peak, it was inoculating around 200,000 people a day, which seems low in comparison to places like the UK. But in a country of 9 million, a very, very small country, that's a huge percentage of the population every single day. And then what happened in February is the Israeli government released the Green Pass.
Israel further eased restrictions after a prolonged lockdown. But gyms, pools, cultural and sports events will be made accessible to Green Pass holders only.
Tell me about the pass. Do you have one?
So, yeah, I have one. It's a kind of modified one because I'm not an Israeli citizen, but it's essentially the same thing. It's an app that you have on your phone, and it's got a QR code on it, which is, you know, one of those square digital boxes. And when you go into a restaurant or a hotel, the idea is that that business will scan it and they will see that you've had your two shots of vaccine and therefore you've got sort of presumed immunity. Or you can also get a green pass if you've had the coronavirus and they think that you're then immune to it.
How widespread is the scheme? What do you need your pass for?
So I'm on the government's health ministry website at the moment. It says the green pass can be used in gyms, swimming pools, restaurants and cafes, hotels, stadiums, pitches, sports events, theatres, cinemas, cultural events, exhibitions. And then at the very end, it says mikvehs for men, which are Jewish bathing houses, which is obviously very specific to Israel. But that's sort of the broad places where you can go and you can exploit your green pass.
And what does it mean for people who don't have a vaccine?
So people who don't have a vaccine, then they can't get the green pass unless they've had a positive coronavirus test. So therefore, they have presumed immunity. But for example, children, right? So in Israel, people who are over the age of 16 can get a vaccine. but people younger than that can't. So children don't have green passes. And there are some sort of ways to get around that in some situations. So, for example, hotels will allow adults to bring their children as long as those children have a recent negative coronavirus test. But that doesn't apply to places like restaurants and cafes. So if you're a child or a person who hasn't been vaccinated, then you're not going to be able to join the rest of society and go and eat inside a cafe or a restaurant.
What, so kids can't go into cafes and restaurants because they're not part of the vaccination programme? Are they actually being turned away?
It basically hasn't been enforced very strictly at all. And so if you do go into a cafe and a restaurant, there's a good chance you'll see a kid in there because the green pass has been released, but many, many businesses aren't even scanning people when they enter on the door. And I think part of that is because Israel has seen infection rates and hospitalizations and deaths from the coronavirus really drop significantly to the point where the government and many, many people see it within manageable levels. And so a lot of restaurants and cafes, they're simply accepting anybody who walks in. You know, since the Green Pass was launched over a month ago, I've only had mine scanned once when I entered a hotel. So people who don't want to get vaccinated or who can't get a Green Pass will still be able to enjoy some of the benefits of the country reopening.
And can you get fake ones, like fake IDs? Is that happening?
Absolutely. People are using them fraudulently. You can print off these QR codes, you could share them with other people. There have been reports of people making them and selling them.
Okay, so there are ways to get them dodgily, and many venues are not enforcing it. But given how extensive the scheme is, are people who might not have got a vaccine getting them because of this?
I've met a few people who have been persuaded to get vaccinated because of the Green Pass. Just the other day, I was out doing a story. I went to a mass vaccination center and I met a woman who's a student at university. And she and her mother didn't want to get the vaccine because they wanted to wait and see what happens. But then her university told her that she wouldn't be allowed to come on campus and attend lectures unless she had a green pass like the majority of the other students. And that was the main reason why she went to get vaccinated.
So she needed a vaccine in order to get a pass to allow her to return to university in person. Is that what this is really about? Is this pass about trying to incentivize or even force people to get a vaccination?
I think it's a large part of it. I'm not sure. The government was aware that people may get vaccinated if they got green passes. I'm not sure this is sort of the primary aim of it. But in Israel, there was concerns around the time that the Green Pass launched because vaccination rates had dropped. They had recently opened to everyone over the age of 16. And unlike older people, you know, there wasn't such enthusiasm for the vaccine among younger groups. And then the Green Pass came out and you kind of had this effect of suddenly the vaccination rates went up again a little bit.
I can definitely see the upside of encouraging more vaccinations, but surely it is someone's right not to have a jab. Are people saying that this system, that in theory at least blocks access to everyday life, is an infringement on people's liberties?
Israel hasn't had to deal with these questions as much as I thought it would, because infection rates have been so low and the rules have been so lax.
One thing that there has been a backlash against, certainly on an international level, has been the fact that while Israel has been hugely successful, the most successful in the world at vaccinating its own population, it hasn't vaccinated neighbouring Palestinians in territory occupied by Israel. Tell me about that.
So when Israel started vaccinating people who live within the country, there were calls for the Israeli government to also vaccinate millions of Palestinians who live under Israeli military rule in the West Bank and also in the blockaded Gaza Strip.
Our Israeli supervisors were vaccinated. I asked my boss if they would give us the vaccine, but he told me, go and ask your Palestinian authority to give it to you.
Now, rights groups were saying that Israel has a sort of humanitarian and legal and moral obligation to vaccinate these people because they're under its effective control. But Israel was saying that it didn't. It pointed to the Oslo Accords, which are these sort of 1990s era agreements it made with the Palestinian Authority, in which they're responsible for healthcare. In the weeks and months since then, Israel has agreed to vaccinate sort of roughly 100,000 Palestinian workers who come into Israel. And it's also sent a few thousand vaccine doses over to the West Bank. But still, the vast majority of Palestinians have not received vaccines.
Are people still protesting about that?
Yeah, people are upset about it because this pandemic has brought up issues of global inequality in a very, very sort of stark way. And one example of that is, for example, if you look in the West Bank, there are Israeli settlers who live over there in settlements, and the vast majority of them are vaccinated. And there are cafes and there are restaurants open in these settlements. And the settlers can go in and eat, whereas the Palestinians living immediately surrounding them cannot. They're living, you know, under lockdown restrictions. The coronavirus is still spreading very rapidly. And the Palestinian Authority, which has sort of limited self-rule, has been working with the World Health Organization and also through, you know, their own diplomatic channels to get vaccines in. But it's going to be months before they reach a state anywhere near where Israel is.
And that is a divide between Palestinians and Israelis. But even within Israel itself, are you able now to tell if this pass, for all its positives, has created a divide between different parts of society?
It hasn't been a good experiment because Israel has had low infection rates, luckily. And so the Green Pass hasn't been tested. It's almost been a symbolic, you know, method for the country to be able to open up and say, oh, look, we're doing this in a responsible way. We're not going to spread the virus. It would be a very, very different case if you still have high infection rates. And in that case, you will see a very, very stark difference between people with the pass and people without.
You've got to be careful about how you do this. And you might need to, you might only be able to implement a thoroughgoing vaccination passport scheme, even if you wanted such a thing, in the context of, you know, when absolutely everybody had been offered a vaccine. So, you know, there are complexities, moral complexities, ethical problems that need to be addressed.
Peter Walker, you're based in Westminster as political correspondent for The Guardian. You've been writing about our proposals for a COVID pass of some kind to reopen society. What exactly is being proposed?
Well, it's not entirely clear yet. I mean, the government are still looking into what might work, but the basic proposal seems to be that whatever pass, which should probably be also app-based, would allow you into places based on one of three things. Either you could show you've been vaccinated. It remains to be seen whether it would be just once or would need to be twice. If you could show that you'd had a negative COVID test either that day or the previous day, or if you could show you had COVID antibodies and that element of the pass would last for 180 days. So you've basically got three ways of getting through.
Okay, so more flexible than the system in Israel because it includes the test option as well. Do we know yet how many venues and what type of venues it might apply to?
We don't know. The only thing that we know, there's two parts to it. There's the documents they've put out, which have basically said it could, in theory, be quite wide. It could be things like sports events and mass events and nightclubs and stuff like that. But the only things they've specifically ruled out are vital public services, public transport, and what's called essential shops. They've not been able to say quite what that is. So they've left open the possibility that even to go into like a closed shop or a cafe or a pub, you might need to show your pass.
We've been hearing about a similar system in Israel, although it's already rolled out. And there hasn't actually been that much controversy, not that much backlash. It's not quite the same here, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, the UK tradition is very, very much this idea that, you know, politicians in the UK like to think we're a country where the police can't kind of ask for your papers. It's not a country where you've had ID cards. There have obviously been times in the past where, you know, certainly the Blair Labour government thought about it. And there was a big pushback. And this is quite a controversial thing. And a lot of Conservative MPs and also the Lib Dems and some Labour MPs are very, very much against this idea. So it's quite politically controversial.
As you just said, it's quite cross-party. And just like with ID cards, quite a mixed bag in ideological terms within that. Who are the groups who feel most strongly about this?
So partly you have on the Conservative side what might be called almost the libertarian right. A lot of these people like Steve Baker, Ian Duncan-Smith, were quite strongly in favour of Brexit. And now quite a lot of them, about 60 or so, are in this group called the COVID Recovery Group, who are mainly pushing for the country to reopen more quickly, but have now also formed themselves against these COVID passes too. And joined with these, you have people who don't normally vote with them or agree with them on most things. You have people on the left of the Labour Party, like Jeremy Corbyn, Clive Lewis, various other people like that. And then finally, again, a third group who doesn't necessarily see eye to eye with the rest of them. You've got the Lib Dems, who, from a civil libertarian point of view, are very, very much against this idea.
It is weird seeing these guys as bedfellows, isn't it? I mean, I remember talking to David Davis, who is on the right of the Conservative Party, about this. And he's actually done quite a lot of work with Jeremy Corbyn. I think they're quite good friends because they really come together on this particular type of issue. Tell me what the specific concerns are.
The concerns are a kind of mix. One of them is just this idea that these COVID certificates, these COVID passes, could end up being a kind of biometric ID via the back door. So you have this kind of app on your phone which says who you are, says what kind of health checks you've had done, et cetera, et cetera. And to basically go most places in normal life, you have to like show it. And it becomes like an ID card. And the worry is, in particular amongst these people, is that this isn't just for 4 months or 6 months, but it carries on and on and on. There's also worries, particularly amongst the Lib Dems, that about the kind of data storage part of it, because they're quite worried, they say, that they don't think that the COVID apps the government has run so far have got a great record.
Fair enough, I think.
And at one point there was this idea, which was being mooted within the government, that the COVID pass could be added onto the NHS Test and Trace app, which MPs were very, very worried about, because the NHS Test and Trace is a completely, it's an app that's not linked to your name or your identity in any way whatsoever. And the idea would be to have a kind of separate wallet with your vaccination stuff. And that's been, you know, dropped. That was never very seriously taken on. But it ties into this whole kind of worries about security and privacy. But you also, particularly from the COVID Recovery Group, Conservative MPs, have this concern that they basically think the vaccination programme should be reason enough to open the country up to pretty much normal on its own.
And beyond those concerns around data and around the information that is actually being collected about all of us, is this sense of, could we end up in a two-tier society? I heard Baroness Shami Chakrabarti, who used to lead Liberty, talking about this.
Crossing the street as opposed to crossing borders, or going to the shops or the pub or the football, that's not a privilege. That should be a fundamental right that comes with living in our community. Internal passports and internal vaccine passports would be a tool for discrimination, bullying, corruption, segregation in a society that needs to move through this pandemic and out of it together.
There is this question, isn't there, of who is vaccinated and who is not? And disproportionately, we worry that those who are not might be more likely to be black and minority ethnic or poorer. I was pretty amazed that in Israel, in quite a few venues, a test is not meant to be acceptable as an alternative. But testing is part of this idea in the UK. Does the government think that by including this, it gets over some of those concerns?
They hope that that will get over that particular thing. I think a vaccination-only pass would really struggle to get through, and I think the government have big problems with that. The addition of the antibody test and the recent negative COVID test does allay the concerns to some extent, but then it also means that, you know, particularly if you can't get an antibody test, it means that if people who haven't been vaccinated have this incredibly difficult time of basically, if they want to go to potentially shops or pubs or anything, having to get tested virtually every day. And, you know, apart from the sheer fuss of it, that also is quite difficult for people to organise. So there is a worry it could discriminate against kind of younger people, people who are kind of working two or three jobs, all that kind of stuff. And it's also just this idea of fundamentally having two classes of people. you know, for whatever reason, people who are allowed in certain venues and people who aren't.
And I guess if you're thinking about it in that way and the additional administrative burden of having to test regularly, then the next question is, how wide does this scheme go? I know you're saying that we don't know at the moment, but they've allowed themselves a lot of scope there.
It's complicated. The things that the government are formally looking at in the sense of having test events is partly sports stuff. The FA Cup semi-final and the final are going to have a few thousand people there. And that'll be used to, I think, mainly try out the idea of rapid testing. There's also going to be various kind of nightclub and comedy venues and things like that. We'll be having test events too. These won't just be kind of testing out a pass. They will also be testing out whether you can just have tests. But there's kind of two possible options, one of which is the government mandates that you have to show your COVID pass to get into certain venues. The other one is it just leaves it up to businesses, and that could make it spread even further. So Boris Johnson at one point quite recently was saying, well, it could be up to individual pubs whether or not you let people in. And that, you know, really, really could be very difficult because the pubs groups were not very keen because it means it's potentially up to them to kind of check people's phones on the door. And, you know, you might have this situation where some pubs can do that and can thus cram a lot more customers in, but others can't.
And some of the venues you're talking about that were supposed to be in the pilots have actually pulled out. What's going on there?
Well, there was one, a Liverpool comedy club, which was listed by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport as taking part in these trials. And people thought that they were taking part in these kind of tests for a kind of COVID passport. And the owners of the club said they got a lot of abuse on social media and people saying you're kind of trying to introduce an apartheid system and stuff like that. And the club was vehement that all they were doing was looking into another part of it connected to tests, not connected to a kind of app-based pass. But eventually the abuse that they got was so bad they decided not to take part at all. And that really shows this idea of kind of discriminatory access is something that would annoy an awful lot of people potentially.
It could be on quite a knife edge for Boris Johnson in terms of a vote on this, unless the Labour Party supports him. Where does the Labour front bench stand on this?
That's a really, really good question. And I spent almost an entire day early this week trying to figure this out. Labour have been showing a bit of leg in terms of voting against all this kind of plan. Keir Starmer gave a Daily Telegraph interview the previous week where he basically said he thought the British instinct would be against passes like this. And they've got this very, very careful line where they say they are both against vaccine passports and also against the government plans as they are.
We do not support the government's plans in their current form. It's as simple as that. In fact, the government's plans seem to be changing on an almost daily basis.
Now, vaccine passport seems to indicate just, you know, a pass based purely on vaccinations, which the government is not putting forward. But when they say they're against the government proposals as they are, that could potentially also mean they're against, you know, the theoretical maximum amount of use for these passes, you know, including shops and pubs and things like that. And I've been trying to pin people in Labour down as to what they would support, and they're really not saying. But I think it's fair to say the door has been left ajar for them potentially to support a kind of milder version, something where the pass is based on both tests and vaccinations, and also where it's maybe just, I don't know, particularly big events like sports events or particularly crowded ones like nightclubs. But that's still to kind of come out in the next, you know, next few weeks probably.
Okay, so that's the politics. Let me ask you about the science. Obviously, there are still questions over the effectiveness of this. We know that rapid testing can be great, but isn't perfect. So some cases of COVID could still get into major events. And we also know that there have been warnings that passes like these might give people a false sense of security. Overall, do scientists advising government tend to support this idea?
I don't think they would necessarily take a view on it because their point would be they can advise on how well or otherwise it's going to work. It's up to the politicians to decide, you know, the balance of risks. But I think that any of the government scientific advisors would be likely to say that if you do want to reopen the economy to mass events, certainly to sports events and nightclubs and things like that, and potentially for pubs and shops, though, you know, that's a kind of judgment call. It's a question of what you want to do. You know, you cannot have any proof of vaccination, any proof of COVID certificates or negative tests, but that would mean that the infection rate is going to climb. So it's a question of, you know, which one of these negatives you want to go for.
Coming up, For how long will COVID restrict our civil liberties? Peter, we know some people feel very strongly about this. They see this as an issue of civil liberties. We've seen protests recently over another issue, over the policing bill. Do you think we could see protests over this?
I think it's interesting. It can be sometimes a kind of highbrow debate in the UK about politics and civil liberties, which doesn't often spill over into the streets. I mean, the policing bill is an exception. I think there's definitely a worry that this all ties in with just this general disquiet about the fact that COVID restrictions are seemingly not about to go away. Because when this last roadmap out of lockdown was first unveiled by Boris Johnson, the promise was that if all went well, then by May, June or July or whenever this year, we'd be back to normal life. And the critics say that the goalposts keep on kind of shifting. You have scientists say, well, we might also need masks and social distancing into the winter. We might need this, we might need that. And now there's this idea that, yes, there might be a semblance of normal life, but it's reliant on people having this kind of phone app to carry around. So everything is fine for now. And the opinion polling seems to show that people are still very supportive of lockdown measures. But, you know, things could potentially change, you know, and reasonably quickly.
Yeah, because if you stand back and think about it, we all understand why we face such massive restrictions, but we shouldn't lose sight of how massive they are. It would have been unthinkable a couple of years ago to imagine the government threatening us with police action for leaving our homes. We've accepted that, but as you say, the restrictions keep rolling on. Is this a moment where we need to be vigilant about how our rights are changing?
I think we potentially do, just in a sense that this is the kind of long game. We're no longer in the kind of emergency part of it, if you like. The government is now looking at how we can live with coronavirus in the longer term. And, you know, this is the worry that a lot of the MPs have got, that if you do have this kind of biometric ID pass, then, you know, once these things get introduced and they're convenient and, you know, the government and officials find them easy, could they stay in the long term? But then balanced against that, you have the very, very genuine desire of people to want to go to shops and to crowd into sweaty nightclubs and to go and cheer on their football teams and all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be a kind of trade-off. And I think it's interesting the civil libertarians are going to be kind of keeping a close watch on this because I think someone needs to.
Peter Walker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was The Guardian's political correspondent, Peter Walker, based in Westminster, and our Jerusalem correspondent, Oliver Holmes. They and many others are following this story. Do keep up with all of it at the website. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and exec'd by Lucy Greenwell. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.